Thanks so much. Thanks to the organizers, especially Susan, for the invitation. It's been fun to be a particle theorist fly on the wall at a nuclear physics conference. I've learned a lot about really interesting measurements that and calculations that people are doing. So I'll sort of give you the dark matter theorist perspective on precision physics with a squid magnetometer detection of axion dark matter. So just a review of things that we do know about dark matter. The evidence for dark matter has been accumulating over more than half a century. And so some things that we know, based on rotation curves of stars and galaxies, you know, the galaxies have halos of dark matter, which extend far out past where the visible light stops. We know that the universe is 26.8% dark matter, and the fact that we know this to three significant digits is amazing. Just comes from fitting this curve of CMB fluctuations. We know from numerical simulations that even dark matter with only gravitational interactions can form interesting, complicated structures. And we even have some handle on the non-gravitational interactions, at the very least an upper bound, saying that it can't interact stronger than the nuclear strength based on measurements from the bullet cluster colliding galaxy clusters. However, there's a lot that we don't know. So this is a lovely cartoon from Tim Tate on the theory space of dark matter. So some things that we don't know. What is the mass of the dark matter? Is it extremely light, sub-EV, or is it even all the way up to almost Planck-scale particles, or maybe even primordial black holes? Is there a whole dark sector, dark particles with their own Higgs bosons, gauge bosons, different self-interactions? What are the non-gravitational interactions with just the standard model? Or what does the local phase-space structure of dark matter look like? Is its velocity distribution Maxwellian like you might expect, or are there interesting streams or caustics or other interesting phase-space structure? So down here in the bottom left corner, there's axion and axion-like particle dark matter, and so that will be the focus of my talk. That's one possible theoretical model for dark matter, which has some interesting experimental consequences. So if we look at the low-energy Lagrangian, the interactions between an axion and the standard model can be divided up into these four operators, plus some other ones, but these are the ones that I'll focus on. So fairly well known is the interaction of the axion field A with FF dual of electromagnetism. So this is characterized by this coupling GA gamma gamma and gives rise to phenomena involving axion photon conversions. Inherited from the coupling of the axion to this, the QCD field strength GG dual, when you float out to low energies, what you find is a nucleon EDM coupling. So I want to specify here that the axion is the thing that's supposed to solve the strong CP problem and get rid of the neutron EDM. So what is that term doing there? Well, all it's saying is that if you have some background axion field, it will give rise to a nucleon EDM. So, and in a couple of slides, I'll show you where that background field will come from. These are non-derivative interactions. Well, the first one is a little marginal because FF dual is itself a total derivative, so in some moral sense, it's actually a derivative sitting on A. But there's also the purely derivative interactions of with the nucleon and with the electron, and so these are called the nuclear axial moment or the electron axial moment, and they end up being proportional to derivatives of A. Crucially, we'll see that they end up being proportional to the spatial gradients of the axion field. So for the QCD axion, there's a relation between the mass and the size of these couplings. So all these are these couplings here have dimensions of 1/mass. So I can characterize them by some scale FA, which from the high energy theory perspective represents the scale at which the PQ symmetry for which the axion is a pseudo Goldstone is broken. But the point is that there's a relation to the mass and the coupling. However, axion-like particles, so particles that have interactions like this but don't solve for you the strong CP problem, can have different relations between M and the dimensionful scale suppressing these couplings. So you have a two-dimensional parameter space instead of a one-dimensional one. So the parameter space, just based on experimental constraints alone, for axion-like particles is enormous. The bottom end of the range, if you want this stuff to be dark matter, then the sort of least you can say is that its Compton wavelength has to fit inside a galaxy. And that says that it has to be heavier than about 10⁻²⁴ eV. But of course, if this stuff isn't dark matter, then you can imagine it can be much lighter than there's some other constraints from CMB polarization and axion photon mixing that come in down there. At the upper end of the mass range, you start to get probed by interesting experiments, for example, energy loss in stars. And so here is now a plot of the axion-like parameter space where the axion photon coupling is on the vertical axis and the mass is on the horizontal one. So this line here, which should be in red, but is instead in some sort of purplish color, represents the QCD axion. So it's not exactly a line because there's some theory uncertainty as to what exactly is the size of this coupling. So there's some order 1 to 10 fudge factor, which represents the width of this line. But anywhere roughly in this region, you can have the axion be, or the axion-like particle be all of dark matter. So it's worth thinking of some experimental probes we can start to look in this region down here. There already is one. The sort of old faithful of axion experiments is the axion dark matter experiment at University of Washington, ADMX, which is already starting to probe the QCD axion in this limited window of masses here. So what's interesting is that ultralight axions that act as dark matter are better described as a field instead of a particle. And if you used to think of axion photon conversions in terms of Feynman diagrams, the perspective here is that if I want to ask how does an electron respond to an external electric or magnetic field, a very calculationally inefficient thing to do would be to add up all of the individual Feynman diagrams corresponding at high energy to Compton scattering. But of course, you sum these all coherently, somehow you'll end up with Maxwell's equations. But it's much simpler to think in terms of electric and magnetic fields. And in the same way, light bosonic dark matter axions in particular behave collectively. If their occupation numbers are large enough, it's useful to think of them as a classical field. And so the intuition for what kinds of experiments might probe this kind of dark matter comes from thinking in terms of, you know, kind of analogies to classical E&M. So just to make that a little more quantitative, if I focus on the mass range for an axion-like particle much less than 1 eV, just given the fact that the local density of dark matter is 0.3 GV per cubic centimeter, that tells me that I have macroscopic occupation numbers of quantum states if this thing is much lighter than an EV. And so macroscopic occupation numbers and the fact that it's a boson, so I can stuff a bunch of these into the same state, means that I can treat this as a classical field. So the spatially homogeneous solution to the Klein-Gordon equation simply is something with constant magnitude which oscillates sinusoidally in time. And the coefficient here is fixed by just setting the energy density of this field equal to the observed energy density of dark matter. And that's what fixes the coefficient here. What's interesting about this from an experimental perspective is the fact that the virial velocity, so the velocity that dark matter picks up just by being gravitationally bound in the galaxy, is on the order of 10 to the minus 3, which is pretty slow. And that tells you that this field is only going to have gradients which go like 10 to the minus 3. And so it's going to be spatially and temporally coherent on macroscopic scales. So basically, it's de Broglie wavelength is a factor of 1,000 bigger than its Compton wavelength, and its coherence time is a factor of 10 to the sixth bigger than you would expect just from the oscillation frequency set by the mass. That means you can, even for something which oscillates on short timescales, the coherence in the field is enhanced by a substantial amount. Oops. Sorry, this didn't show up. So in a background of axion dark matter, so let's say I plug in this classical background field into that Lagrangian and see what kind of equations of motion I get. I get some interesting oscillating observables. So for example, in the presence of external electric and magnetic fields E0 and B0, I get these harmonic response fields, BR and ER, from my static fields E and B because they couple to something which has time dependence, which is this background axion field. Likewise, that EDM term, so again, the QCD axion is supposed to cancel off for me the static EDM of the neutron. However, what I get is a harmonically oscillating or time-varying EDM of the neutron. And then that axial moment for the nucleons gives rise to a spin-dependent force, which couples the gradient of the axion field to the nuclear spin. And because gradients of the axion field are related to the dark matter velocity, that'll effectively give me an experiment which can probe the dark matter velocity and the way that it couples to spin, just kind of like an external magnetic field. So these operators suggest two strategies to look for light axion-like dark matter. So one of them is spin precession sourced by an axion background, and this is exemplified by the Casper experiment, where you have a sample which is magnetized, and in the presence either of an external electric field or non-zero axion velocity or field gradient, you get spins which precess, and then you have a transverse magnetization which is proportional to those two couplings, either the EDM coupling or the axial moment. You can also turn on a magnetic field and look for that magnetic response and then try to detect the axion source flux. And so this is the abracadabra experiment proposed by myself and my collaborators, which I'll go into detail about a little bit later, and that's proportional to the axion-photon coupling. But in both cases, the signal is a weak very, very weak oscillating magnetic field, which lends itself to detection using squids. Hence, the proposed title for this talk was Squid Magnetometer Detection, because we're looking for very weak magnetic fields sourced by the axion. So I actually had to learn about squids for the first time as a result of working on this. So let me give a very sort of theorist cartoon level introduction to how a squid works. So a squid is a superconducting quantum interference device. But the cartoon picture is it's an extremely sensitive flux to voltage amplifier. So if I have some magnetic flux that passes through this superconducting loop with these two Drosius junctions, a change in flux is going to induce a current across the junction, because flux has to be quantized. You get an induced supercurrent to cancel off the external flux. But depending on how much flux you put through, it might be energetically favorable for the current to go around clockwise or counterclockwise. And so as a result, the voltage that you measure across this device is periodic in the flux quantum, which in sort of everyday units is 10 minus 15 Tesla meter squared. However, the sensitivity of a squid is much better than that, because if you tune your bias current to put you at the point of maximum slope on this V phi curve, then a tiny, tiny change in flux can induce a macroscopic change in voltage. So that's why squids are so good at measuring very small magnetic fields. So there's some irreducible noise that comes from these devices. So you have to have a shunt resistor across these Josephson junctions, and so you get some thermal noise and correspondingly some current fluctuations. However, they're at the level of 10 to the minus 6 times that flux quantum. So if you imagine a squid of area 30 micrometers squared, that gives you a field sensitivity of picotesla, or a spectral density of picotesla per root hertz at the squid. The ultimate limit of a squid, or the so-called quantum limit, is just limited by shot noise, so just the counting of single electrons that are going across the junction. If you cool this down enough, this will start to dominate over thermal noise. But even so, for a large-ish inductance of a squid, you only get to win by about a factor of 2 compared to the typical squid noise. So this is just saying that squids are fantastic devices, and they've almost reached their quantum limit in their sensitivity. And so they're very good magnetometers. Of course, you can imagine trying to run any of these experiments with different magnetometers, which have different signal-to-noise characteristics, and that might be potentially better for some experimental setups. So once you've got your flux through the squid, then the question is, how do you actually read it out? So there are two main methods in squid magnetometry, so-called untuned or tuned magnetometers. I'll refer to these as broadband and resonant circuits for reasons that will become clear in a second. So here's the circuit diagram. So what happens is I put some flux through the squid, and then that induces some, I put some flux through a pickup loop, and then that induces some current through this pickup loop, which ends up being proportional to the total inductance of the circuit. So now I couple that current into the squid through this input inductor Li here. And so the flux that the squid feels is proportional to the current with the factor of the mutual inductance between these two things. So basically, this is just the question of, I have some macroscopic flux. Now, how do I get it into my squid? And it's not always the most efficient to put the squid directly in the magnetic field. Instead, what you want is some pickup loop, which feels the flux itself, and then you run it through a circuit. And then the squid feels that flux through the current going through this inductor. So the interesting thing about this circuit is that if every component here is superconducting, you're at low enough temperatures, and you're at relatively low frequencies, it's a good approximation to say this thing has zero thermal noise. This is basically a purely inductive circuit. And then the noise of this circuit ends up just being dominated by the intrinsic noise of the squid. So the reason I refer to this as a broadband circuit is that the response here is frequency independent. So it's true that just by Faraday's law, the current that goes around here goes like d phi dt, but because of the factor of I omega L and the impedance of the inductor, the omegas cancel out. And this thing is effectively a frequency independent circuit. Of course, the other thing you could do is you could put a capacitor in this pickup circuit to make an RLC circuit, and then try to tune these components to put it on resonance to match whatever frequency of the signal that you think you're inputting. So in that case, the behavior of this circuit is determined by the Q factor, which depends on the parameters as follows. Here, actually, what's happening is that now there is an irreducible resistance that the circuit sees. Basically, the fact that you're trying to cancel off the real part of the impedance means that now this is seeing some irreducible resistance. And that means that the sources of signal and noise are the same. Basically, you're seeing current in the circuit or thermal fluctuations of that current, and that's driving the noise. So now the noise source of this, so the price that you pay for trying to make a resonant circuit is that at least for Q up to 10 to the 8 at 0.1 Kelvin, thermal noise dominates over the squid noise. There's some other components that you can put in the circuit. So for example, you can do what's called feedback damping to try to match the bandwidth of the circuit to whatever intrinsic bandwidth you have of your signal. So which one of these readout modalities works better depends on the frequency. So there's some really interesting results from medical magnetometry trying to do weak field MRIs, looking at the signal-to-noise behavior of these tuned or untuned circuits. And the interesting thing is, so here this horizontal line is the flat response of the broadband circuit, and here's the response of the resonant circuit. And so there's some crossover frequency below which a broadband circuit is in principle better. However, you need to make your pickup circuit superconducting, and so you need to be at low temperatures, and also you can't be in strong magnetic fields, so that circuit just won't work. But it's interesting, there's a sort of a complementarity between these two readouts that depending on what the frequency of your signal is, one might be better than the other. So now let me discuss how this Casper experiment works. So this is effectively a nuclear magnetic resonance experiment sourced instead of with an NMR pulse, now with axion dark matter. So nuclei, as I've discussed, that are immersed in this classical background axion field can have either oscillating EDMs and or a spin-dependent force on them, depending on which one of these operators is present. So here, the coefficient of this EDM just goes like this, the dark matter density. So the more stuff you have, the higher amplitude you have. And the same thing here. Note here this factor of V that comes from the axion field gradient. So this is a sort of a force which depends on the velocity of the dark matter field as seen from in our frame on Earth. So now the name of the game is you polarize some spins in this material, and then you watch them process around this vector here, which can either be an external E field in the case of an oscillating EDM, or the axion field velocity itself. So you orient your experiment just to make sure that the thing that's polarizing the spins is not parallel with the velocity. And then you will see some transverse magnetization from the precession. Just like in NMR, if the frequency of this source here is tuned to the Larmor frequency, which is to the mu times the external B field, then you get a resonant effect. Your signal can build up linearly in time over the coherence time, and then that's the thing that you want to try to detect. So what's interesting here, so this frequency MA is just set by fundamental physics. That's just the axion mass. There's nothing you can do. So you have to scan over different B field strengths to try to find the one that matches the actual axion that's there. So you get to tune this, but you don't get to tune that. That's just given to you by nature. So here is the proposed reach of these two Casper experiments. So Casper Electric is the one that is looking for the nucleon coupling with the external E field, and Casper Wind is the one that's looking for the axial moment coupling with the dark matter velocity. So what you see is that there's a maximum frequency that you can probe, basically because it's hard to put in a field bigger than 20 Tesla in the lab, and so that's what sets the cutoff on the right here. What's really interesting about the nucleon EDM search is that it's a non-decoupling signal. So let me go back one slide to explain what I mean. That here, what you have is you have this coupling G, which is proportional to 1 over FA, but MA is also proportional to 1 over FA, and so those things cancel out. And so actually the physical effect here does not decouple as you tune the axion decay constant bigger and bigger. So that's why the reach of this experiment doesn't die as you go to smaller and smaller axion masses, which is very interesting. It means you can probe, in principle, an FA corresponding to the Planck scale, so a Petri-Quinn symmetry which is broken to the highest physical scale that we feel like we understand, and the corresponding axion masses is within range of a phase two of this experiment with a stronger B field. So the dashed red line here represents the irreducible magnetization noise for a given sample size. The bigger you can make your sample, the better that'll get, and so that line will go down. And so what you see is that at least this Casper Electric experiment can probe the QCD axion line for masses corresponding to less than about 10 to the minus 9 eV, corresponding to decay constants of the gut scale and above. The Wind experiment is measuring a different coupling here, and because it has to be proportional to the axion velocity, which is on the order of 10 to the minus 3 if you have a Maxwellian velocity distribution, that's a suppression, which means that it can't quite reach the QCD line. However, it's still interesting. There's all this parameter space up here for other axion-like particles, which aren't necessarily the one that solves the strong CP problem. So at least as proposed in the references up here, so this is an experiment which has a resonant effect, so you have to tune this Larmor frequency to equal the axion mass. But the readout here is actually broadband. So they're using this untuned magnetometer as a readout, which means that here their noise is all limited by squid noise. So it's worth pointing out just one thing about this parameter space up here above the QCD line for the nucleon EDM coupling. So this reference here pointed out this region is actually fine-tuned for the following reason, that if you have a coupling to the nucleon, that meant that at high energies you had to have couplings to GD dual, which meant that this thing couples the QCD just like a QCD axion. You can call it a QCD axion or the QCD axion, but it does all the things that the axion is supposed to do. So in particular, it picks up a mass from QCD effects. And being above this line means that you have less mass than you would have expected from QCD effects, which requires a fine-tuning in your Lagrangian to cancel off that mass. And in fact, that fine-tuning also reintroduces, to some extent, the strong CP problem. So it's interesting that this experiment can probe this region up here, but for theoretical reasons, it might be considered fine-tuned. Okay, now let me go on to the second of these general strategies, exploiting the coupling to electromagnetism to detect axions. So here is Maxwell's equations with the corrections from a background axion field. So I'm going to ignore the gradients because they're proportional to the velocities, which are small. I'm also going to ignore this term. I'm now going to be working at low frequencies compared to the size of the experiment enough that I can be in the quasi-static approximation, familiar from beginning E&M. And I can read the right-hand side of this equation as an effective current. So it's a source for the curl of B, which means, for all intents and purposes, it's a current whose amplitude is proportional to the dark matter density and this axion-photon coupling. And it oscillates harmonically at a frequency equal to the axion mass. Unlike most currents that we're familiar with, this one, instead of circling around lines of magnetic field, it's parallel to the lines of the external B field. So now the question is, what's the best way to detect an oscillating current? There are two general ways. You can go to infinity and look for radiated power. This thing will have some dipole moments which will radiate. Or you can go locally and look at time-varying flux induced by this thing. And that's the strategy that we're going to take in this experiment, and it's the one that's appropriate for this quasi-static approximation. So just to give you a toy example for how an experiment like this would work, let's take a solenoid. So that means that I have a current which is wrapping circumferentially around a cylinder. That gives me a large homogeneous B field going down the axis of the cylinder. So now, in the presence of axion dark matter, that means that I get an effective current which follows the lines of B. But now that I have this effective current, I can ignore this original B field that I had and just consider the equivalent problem now of this J effective, this weak response current, which is going down the axis of the solenoid. In that case, the equivalent E&M problem is now just one of a current carrying wire, which means that I'm going to have B field lines, so response field lines, which circle around the wire. And of course, these aren't confined to the wire. So despite the fact that my initial B field is confined to the inside of this wire, the field lines that circle around go outside, and I can, in principle, detect the axion-induced magnetic flux looking outside the strong field region. So the problem with solenoids is that any finite length solenoid will have appreciable fringe fields that are sitting out here. So the thing to do to mitigate that is to bend the solenoid around into a toroid. So now instead of a current-carrying wire, I have a current-carrying loop. The associated B field lines will circle around, and in particular in the center, they're all pointing in the same direction. So I have some net flux, some net time-dependent flux through the center of this that I can then try to measure and feed into a squid with either these broadband or resonant readout circuits. And the point is that for an ideal solenoid, or excuse me, for an ideal toroid, there's no flux through the center if there's no axion background, and so I'm looking in this zero field region. So our proposal for this we called Abracadabra, which does stand for something, a broadband resonant approach to cosmic axion detection with an amplifying B field ring apparatus. Well, you can thank my collaborator, Jesse Thaler, and his wife, who are so the Dark Light Experiment, I don't know if any of you have heard of that, is also another wonderful acronym. That's why it's so much fun to work with him. among other reasons. Good. So the game here is that we're going to put a superconducting pickup loop in the center to try to capture this flux. I'm going to work in a limit, as I mentioned, where all the dimensions of the experiment are small compared to the axion wavelength, so that I'm in the quasi-static approximation. Then I get this time-dependent flux, which is proportional to the magnitude of the external field, the axion-photon coupling, square root of the dark matter density, an effective toroid volume, so the more B field volume I have, the better I do, and it oscillates harmonically. So once again, depending on this frequency, whether a broadband or resonant readout wins will depend on how big this frequency is. So the reach of the proposed experiment is shown here. So once again, this coupling is now the axion-photon coupling, a different coupling than either of the two Casper setups. So the QCD band is here. The orange curves are resonant readout, and the blue curves are broadband. And you can see there's a crossover for the temperature that we chose was 0.1 Kelvin. And so the crossover here corresponds to about 10 to 20 kilohertz, or equivalently about 10 to the minus 9 eV for axion masses. So because I have to be in the quasi-static approximation, or this near-field approach doesn't actually work, the bigger I make my experiment, the sooner I have to cut off the reach. So actually, if you build a smaller experiment, you can, in principle, probe higher axion masses. So you kind of want to combine some amount of a smaller prototype and then a bigger prototype to go deeper here in the coupling and smaller in axion masses. But what's interesting is now we're looking at being able to probe the QCD band now for decay constants at the gut scale or below, which is highly complementary to these Casper setups. Just to note here, so this upturn here is just the fact that squids have 1 over F noise at very low frequencies. This is on the order of tens of hertz. We've thought about some ways to mitigate that, but it gets harder and harder once you get down to low frequencies. On the other hand, if you're talking about the QCD axion, now you're talking about decay constants above the gut scale, which don't really make sense. So this region makes sense for axion-like particles, but that's why this curve cuts off right here. So the point is that now these two readout strategies are very complementary, that a combination of them can probe a large region of parameter space, which is not currently probed by other experiments. So this experiment, there's a prototype being built at MIT, which is small, so 10 centimeters as opposed to the meter-sized experiments which we'd want eventually. The idea here is, so here's a toroid, and so you have some pickup in the middle, and then that will read out the magnetic flux that'll go into a squid. And for either broadband or resonant readout at a certain frequency, with 1 month of data taking, we can already probe some unexplored parameter space. Of course, not even getting close to the QCD line, but it's still interesting that dark matter could still potentially live here, and there's some interesting physics you can do with a first stage experiment. So here's the outlook for looking for QCD axion dark matter. So now not axion-like particles, specifically the QCD axion. So it can be dark matter sort of anywhere from about 10 to the minus 5 eV all the way down to where the decay constant is the Planck scale, is about 10 to the minus 13 eV. The ADMX experiment is already probing, or will probe some of the mass region here. The abracadabra experiment does well for decay constants below the gut scale. The Casper setup does well above the gut scale. And so we have really nicely this overlapping probe of gut scale physics using precision measurements. So this is really fun. You know, we're sort of using elementary E&M to look for physics which might live at one of the highest fundamental scales we can think about. One more interesting thing to note here is that there's a very interesting proposal just a little while ago about using the fact that LIGO is now an excellent black hole observatory, and that axions can, through the super radiance effect, can spin down high spin black holes. And so if you see black holes with high enough spin, you would know there's not an axion there. And the range of their parameter space is very close to the one probed by Casper. But what's really interesting about that is that it doesn't matter at all whether or not the axion is dark matter. So all you need is one quantum fluctuation, so a single quantum to fluctuate in, and then you have an exponential buildup of this axion cloud around a black hole making this effect happen. And so in some sense, this is slightly more general in that it doesn't require the QCD axion to be dark matter, but if it was, then the Casper experiment would be able to detect it. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
If you don't
Absolutely not. So they're entirely independent. It was just observed that it's possible that the QCD axion could be dark matter. But you could have a QCD axion that made up a negligible fraction of dark matter, it would still solve the strong CP problem, and then precisely this black hole superradiance experiment would be a good place to look for it. That's right. That's right.
Why could you leave it out in one case and not
in the other? Basically, because when you're trying to kill the real part of the impedance by putting the circuit on resonance, that means that so there's always some resistance in parallel. In this, you imagine the superconductor is having some small normal component with a resistance in parallel. You always see that resistance when you kill the other resistance by trying to kill the real part of the impedance. But you're not necessarily doing that with the inductive circuit. Sorry, you're trying to kill both the real and imaginary parts of the impedance, and so you end up seeing the resistance in parallel. But for the broadband circuit at low frequencies, you don't. So it's there, but it's always...
It's
just shunted out, and you're always dominated by the squid noise. That's right.
I guess if you have this time-varying electric dipole moments that they cancel out in normal EDM experiments, right? So you cannot see any, you shouldn't see anything there because it oscillates on average to zero?
That's right. So if you're not looking on timescales corresponding to the frequency, on average you would see nothing, which is why these are very complementary to the things that measure over long times.
But is there some hope of seeing something like this in the storage ring experiments where you could maybe get also some resonance tuning there?
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this with Patty Fox at Fermilab, actually, about whether or not the measurements of G-2E are actually sensitive to effective forces from an axion background. The problem is the coupling is usually weak enough that it's not a very strong effect, but yes, it's a very interesting direction to look in.
The size of the EDM that was produced was 10 to the minus 35 E centimeters as the oscillating component, and that's related directly to the properties of the QCD axion. That wouldn't be a background in any experiment, since it's far smaller than...
Sorry, you mean that's the value you get when you plug in the local dark matter density?
Yeah.
Right. So there are two things here. So thing number one is we don't actually know we think we know the local dark matter density, but it's possible that it could be greatly enhanced on Earth. And so in principle, we don't know the magnitude of that coefficient.
It's not going to be five orders of magnitude. What I'm saying is the oscillating induced EDM is far smaller than any static EDM experiment is going to reach, and so in a sense, you're not going to see it in an EDM experiment.
Okay, good. So I guess the my answer to the question about storage rings is more if you measure something for a long time that has some time varying component superimposed on top, that could you ever discover it? And maybe all I've thought about is actually like the trajectories of particles in G-2 experiments. But there might be something there, but I think you're probably right that given that it's small, it's not going to contribute to most of them.
I have a question about your precise value, the local dark matter density.
Yeah.
For these ultralight candidates, can't we expect gravitational focusing effects because of the sun? There were local modifications, essentially. I dare say they depend on mass.
Yes.
Do we know very well what they are?
No. It's an extremely hard problem to try to figure out how you get from the evolution of an ultralight field into the local density that we see here. Do axions form clumps? So there have been proposals that you basically get these droplets, which are self-gravitationally bound. As far as I know, it's highly controversial and not resolved, and it could differ vastly from that which you would expect for WIMP dark matter.
Very well. So for your particular numerical estimates, what numbers did you use?
Just the number for the WIMP, so the 0.3 GeV per...
So in fact, you could push maybe to much greater sensitivity if these effects were operative.
Sure. Or you could get unlucky and there wouldn't be much here. But
that's probably true.
In the standard scenario, you get an upper bound for FA from cold dark matter. I think it's also on this plot.
Yeah.
Around, how do you get around that? If you want to measure for bigger values of A.
So that value corresponds to the so-called misalignment mechanism for the production of axion dark matter, which says that there's an order one field displacement. So it's a fine tuning to say that the initial field displacement is very small. But then again, you know, anthropics, you could wave your arms. I mean, there's theoretical prejudices towards the values probed by ADMX, but it, by no means is it a hard and fast theorem that you can't get larger FA.
Do all these experiments keep information about the phase of the incoming axion field, or does that get thrown away?
Currently, I don't believe so, but that's an interesting way to go. I mean, basically, what you're doing is you're just trying to take advantage of the coherence time of the field, mm-hmm. and once the field is stopped being coherent, then basically you just need to stack the next histogram on top of the one before.
So if you had two displaced experiments, you would see them out of phase by an amount of the...
Absolutely, and you can measure the relative velocity, and there's all kinds of amazing things you could do if only you see the signal. So, yeah, I mean, there's real possibility for directional detection here, which is much easier than it would be for whiff dark matter, for example.
As long as it doesn't get thrown away in some sort of squeezing of the state somewhere else, because that can also happen.
Sure.
Thank the speaker again.